ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Corbin Middlemass and the voice of Summer, Jim Maxwell, for ABC Sport. As we count down Jim's Ashes memories, we got you to bowl us an over of memories. We've gone 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. We're at number one, and it is the closest finish in Ashes history and in living memory, a series which a lot of people regard as good as we've had in Ashes cricket. Jim, take us to Edgbaston 2005.
Yes, well, you'd have to say going into this game, it did have the look of, oh, well, it's another series in England during the dominant McGrath-Warn era, where Australia just kept winning. And they won at Lord's, and they won convincingly.
McGrath bowls and Jones is off the edge, caught by Warn, it's all over. Australia have won the game by 239 runs. McGrath takes the final wicket.
Although England had thrown a few meat pies at the Australians, there have been a few belligerent deliveries from Harmison and Jones, and they'd roughed Australia's batsmen up a bit. But even though Kevin Peterson had made a very impressive debut, McGrath running down the hill at Lord's was too good, and Australia won easily. I can remember at the end of the game, I was chatting to Rod Marsh, who I think had just come out of a period of being involved with English Academy and the rest of it. And I said, what did you think? Are we going to win this series 5-0? He said, I wouldn't discount England. Well, history proves that he was spot on, but not in the way that we thought, because there's no doubt there are all sorts of trigger moments in series, and this one was probably one of the biggest trigger moments in Ashes history, when McGrath trod on the ball before the start of the Test match. And out of that moment came an extraordinary game of cricket, but a complete change in momentum in the series.
So the thing that stood out as much as anything, not just McGrath on the ball, but then Ricky Ponting went to the toss, knowing that he didn't have Glenn McGrath on his team sheet, won the toss and chose to field. So it was a bold move by the Australians. They stuck England in. We talk about the Baz ballers nowadays. This is long before that. All of a sudden, 400 on the board inside 80 overs, and England were riding this game.
Warn bowls now, and Flintoff swings in the air, down the ground, straight towards the boundary. It goes for another 4, 6. It's gone for 6. How did that go for 6? He just bunted that over the top, and it's cleared the rope down at long off. The 6th of the day, 4 for 263. This is extraordinary cricket.
Yes, it did seem a bit odd at the time that Ponting should stick with the master plan, which had obviously been in the lead-up. All the discussion had been about, if you win the toss at Edgbaston, you should bowl. But, you know, the bloke up there with the Angels would be saying, no, you win the toss. 9 times out of 10, you bat, and the 10th, well, you're still bad.
Yes.
But that doesn't seem to be the case in the contemporary game. We're often seeing sides bowl first, and that's fine if you've got the armoury, and Australia would have had their best armoury had McGrath not trodden on the ball. The fact that Kasparovic was brought in without any cricket, really, so he was underdone, meant that Australia were obviously a little bit weakened, and the pitch looked pretty good to be batting on. It might have been a hollow conviction, not sure, from Ponting, but there was a sense that, you know, Australia had the momentum and they could keep it going without McGrath because they had Warn, and Warn was a factor. That's what they decided to do. But England, as we'd seen in the previous match, were up for the fight, and they came out at the gallop against Australia.
Lee bowls to him, and he's forward and he's driving magnificently through the covers for another 4. Cop that. Oh, 18 from the last over before lunch.
Do you remember when McGrath stepped on the ball and word started to filter around? What was that like in the press centre as all of a sudden there was whispers that, hang on, McGrath's hurt himself in the warm-up here and there's a chance he's going to miss? Was it obvious initially that, yes, he's hurt his ankle and the game's over, or was there still a thought that, oh, maybe it's just a rolled ankle and we'll stick him out there anyway?
I think it was one of those evolving situations. Was the more time went, towards the moment of the toss, it was clear that McGrath had a problem other than perhaps just turning on his ankle and twisting it, and he'll be okay. And then off, I think he'd been off for an x-ray. Something occurred in there, and then the realisation that he wasn't going to play. And given the fact that, as we partially knew, Gillespie wasn't quite the bowler of before, and that the other two were Tait and Kasparovic's support, unless you're bowling a lot in the nets, you're not playing any cricket, because that's the way that the schedule is. So I think once reality hit us, we thought, this is going to be interesting. What'll happen at the toss? Hopefully you can win the toss and bat. It gets bonding out of an awkward situation, because I remember talking to John Inverarity, who had a fair bit to do with Warwickshire in the lead up to this game. And he said, that's the way it goes this year. You win the toss and you bowl and you get the result. There was a lot of this sort of talk around, which obviously and kept the conviction up for Ponting to have a bowl. Australia definitely weakened from the moment that incident occurred, and the more so as we realised the seriousness of his injury.
So England led by 99 on the first innings, and as Australia do, they fight their way back, and England were really on the ropes when the 10th wicket partnership was formed. So England all of a sudden 9 down, and the lead at that stage, Jim, was 231. If it wasn't for a 10th wicket stand worth 50, which took the overall target from 231 to 281 between Andrew Flintoff and Simon Jones.
Yeah.
Bradley, it is in now to Flintoff. Flintoff heaves at that. It's gone over the pavilion. It's an enormous six. My goodness me. You won't see a bigger six in 100 years. It went right over the pavilion. I should think into the road behind. It was the most extraordinary stroke.
In the end, those 50 runs were crucial in a game which was obviously decided by the smallest margin in Ashes history.
It's interesting to think back in the history of close finishes and partnerships like that that just swung the balance in the final analysis. My mind's eye, excuse me, fans, but I am an oldie, goes back to McKenzie and Davidson at Manchester in 1961. I think they had a 98 for the last wicket, and then they bowled England out. That's why we love the game and Test cricket in particular, because you get these moments in the game where things don't seem to be rational. It just turns over. Shane Warne took 40 wickets in this Ashes series and Australia lost.
Harmison comes forward and an appeal for a catch in close. He's out. First ball, Warne's on a hat-trick.
And it looked like Australia certainly had a chance of winning it going into the fourth innings. But what happened after that was a heart attack material, really, for everyone.
So 8 for 175, chasing 281, and you thought at that stage that the Aussies are no chance this is over and England's going to win. With Brett Lee batting, firstly with Shane Warne and then with Michael Kasperwit, so the guy that gets the late call-up for Glenn McGrath, who steps on the ball in the morning of day one, all of a sudden is there at the end of the Test match, ultimately playing a critical role. I think you mentioned in one of our earlier chats that you were on the commentary towards the back end of this, thinking that Australia are about to pull off an incredibly unlikely victory from that position. So from multiple stages throughout the match where this team was on top and then it swung back the other way to all of a sudden be 8 for 175. And yet there were moments towards the end where all of a sudden it was looking like the Aussies were going to pull off a famous victory of their own.
Well, Peter Baxter was the producer on Test Match Special in those days, and I think he may have started this tradition, as it were, of the commentator from the likely team should be on at the end, and that's why I was on at the end. And really, he was within a yard of being right, because as it turned out, the penultimate ball of that Test match was cover driven by Lee.
Harmison goes up and Lee chases a full toss and hits it hard for cover. Just a single out there. Harmison probably looking for a Yorker, overpitched, and they've got the protection on the boundary out there, so it's down to 3 to win.
If you think about where we are in the adjudication process of cricket now, there was no DRS in those days in the way there is today. So Kasparovic didn't have his hand on the bat as he gloved the ball down the leg side.
England striving for this last wicket. They've been doing that for a while. Harmison comes up and bowls, and Kasparovic goes back, and parries one as he caught down the leg side. There's an appeal for catches out. England have won. England have won by 2 runs.
How would you know if you're umpiring? It's all happening in an instant, and the finger went up and he was on his way. That would have robbed history, potentially, of one of the great English victories or great finishes if Australia had won by 1 wicket. And funnily enough, those two batsmen, Lee and Kasparovic, a year later, people forget about this, were there when we were 8 down in Johannesburg against South Africa. Justin Langer supposed to bat at number 11 because he'd had a head knock.
Concussion.
They didn't have the concussion replacements in those days. And that was the big question. Would he come out and bat? No, yes. We didn't know. It didn't matter in the end.
Yeah.
Of course, they got the runs. Kasparovic and Lee, and Australia won by 2 wickets. There's a lot that happens around close finishing in these games. And one of the reasons you pick out this game as a memorable Ashes moment is because of that brilliant photo taken at the end,
yeah,
with Andrew Flintoff consoling a distressed Brett Lee on his haunches at the non-striker's end. And that is a wonderful photo,
yeah,
to have when you think about the spirit of the game and the rest of it. And that's another reason why you remember things that happened as they did in this game.
It's been an enduring photo, isn't it? That indelible image of the pair of them together. When you were on at the time and you're calling, was it something that just happened quickly and then went, and then it wasn't until the photo afterwards that it became the moment that it was? Do you remember it being a particular thing
It was a flash to the side.
England players surrounding themselves and slapping each other on the back. Flintoff came over and shook Brett Lee's hand. Both the Australian batsmen just stood there, dumbfounded for a moment or two that the game could have ended like that.
All of this happened before lunch on the fourth day. So it was a quick test match. And of course, it was a huge crowd at Edgbaston, being a Sunday. That is one of the more vocal crowds in England at Edgbaston. It was a serious momentum shift in the whole series, which was almost followed up immediately when they had the game at Manchester and Australia wriggled out with a draw. A defining moment of all the moments was the finish of that extraordinary game of cricket. And England, in a way, they need to say, thank you, Vern McGrath. You're always tipping 5-0 against us. We got you this time when you trot on the ball.
How important was this series, Jim, do you think, in the broader context of the Ashes? And it felt like it just revitalised the whole concept. Cricket lovers obviously knew all about it and what it was about, but it felt like it sort of grew again almost. The casual fans were drawn in a way that perhaps Australia's dominance had become almost monotonous in a way that how good they'd been for a period of time. How important was this, with the result going the other way, just to breathe life into world cricket?
It was very important. I think it's worth remembering at the time, Australia had won a World Cup in South Africa in 2003. They went on in 2007 to win again. So Australia were a very dominant team. They'd come out of India the previous year with a win, with Adam Gilchrist in charge at the time when Ponting had broken his finger. Australia were very much a dominant team in world cricket, and we were hoping that England would stand up with a strong performance. And an indication that most Australians thought they wouldn't was the fact that that series was on SBS television.
Yeah.
Because Channel 9 said, no, we don't want the rights to it. It's going to be so one-sided. It's going to muck up our programming. That's what the atmosphere was like around in the preliminary to the series. There was the expectation that Australia would cruise to victory again. So as far as the Ashes was concerned, this was one of the biggest moments in 10 or 15 years for the future and tradition of the best series ever played.
Felt like the Australian cricket team at that particular time, they had so many all-time greats running around out there that it felt like they had a lot of teams beat almost before they got there, that they had this sort of aura of invincibility. Do you feel like this series went away to stripping some of that away, that even the dominant teams that we've seen in recent times that Australia have had and the personnel's changed, that they haven't been feared perhaps by opposition nations in the way that this team was up until 2005. Is that fair?
I think so. I mean, as we've mentioned before, the fact that Australia arguably had the two finest bowlers in tandem, well, Test history might be too big a line to swing, but certainly in Australian cricket history. It's true that the most dominant player in Test history was Bradman. And going the other way to the modern era with those two bowlers, that's what happened. The suffocation caused by the quality of their bowling was a huge factor. But just gradually, not immediately, that may have been a little bit dissipated. But it still didn't really happen until both of them retired.
You've been behind the mic for over 50 years. You've covered some great Australian teams and some magnificent wins and at times against the odds, victories away from home. This is a series loss, but is it the best series you've ever covered?
Wow. There's a lot going into that. There's a few more Ashes series to consider in recent times. And you'd have to think of the series in the West Indies when Shane Warne was dropped and we needed to win the last test to square the series because of the brilliance of Brian Lara. That was one of the best. Couple in South Africa, pretty much on the edge in India. I mean, it could go on. I'm just trying to flush out one in particular. But we've just done it, haven't we, Corbin? We've just done it. This is the top of the Ashes. It's the big game at Edgbaston in 2005, 20 years ago today.
Absolutely. That is number one on Jim's Ashes hit list. Jim, it's always a great thrill to work with you, but appreciate sitting here in such an iconic place with you in the home dressing room at the Sydney Cricket Ground, a place which you love so much, and talking us through your Ashes memories. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for guiding me along, Corbin. It's been fun.
The great Jim Maxwell. You'll hear him on the Ashes coming up this summer or here on ABC Sport.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.